still talking about how the people were stirred to resume the construction of the temple. But they were stopped. The people of the land came and questioned that. Well, they were not stopped. They had been stirred in the spirit. They had momentum, and they continued to work as the people questioned them. And the people said, "Who gave you the authority to do this?" And they explained how Cyrus had sent them from Persia, from Babylon, where they had been held captive, to build the temple. And they confessed honestly and candidly that the reason they lost the temple was because their ancestors had displeased God. What that is on the screen in our topic of legal wrangling is that's a weasel. And when we associate weasels with people who are often like, well, it's a synonym for lawyers, no offense, jokingly, but slippery, sly, cunning. Weasels are what my father-in-law would say, they're limber as a snake. And they are kind of a synonym for people who launch frivolous lawsuits, lawsuits without substance. And this action of the people of the land against the Jews in building the temple is kind of like a lawsuit. They're suing them. They're trying to get a stop work order. And they're seeking a decision from someone who can judge and render a decision. They write to King Darius. Well, before we get into that, let's look at how people got into Judah from Babylon. And Ezra and Nehemiah tells of three different waves of people at different times. The first one, of course, was in Ezra 1, chapter 1. It was under Cyrus. It was he ruled in 559 to 530, but his decree was in 538, and the people started on the move in 537, led by Zerubbabel. So that's one wave. They came with about 50,000 people. The second wave is 13 years after the temple was completed. It was under Artaxerxes, and this was the group of people who came with Ezra. This was in 458 B.C., and he brought around from 5 to 7,000. He gives a count of 5,000, but it might have been more because that figure might not include women and children. And then, did I say 13 years? 58 years. It was actually 58 years after the completion of the temple, Ezra came. So that's the second wave. The third wave was a smaller wave. This was with Nehemiah, and he came 13 years after Ezra. This is still under the reign of King Artaxerxes. And Nehemiah was appointed governor of the province of Judah. In their language, it was called Yehud, and he was governor of and in charge of Jerusalem and the area around it. He had a 12-year term as governor, and he came, since he was an official person, he came with soldiers. Okay, so that's a movement of a mass group of people. And let's see how the Bible tells us, and we trust the record of the Bible, how Nehemiah set out from, he was in Susa, so he set out from Artaxerxes. It says in chapter 2, verses 7 through 9, "I also said to him," Nehemiah speaking to King Artaxerxes, "If it please the king, may I have letters to the governor of Trans-Euphrates so that they will provide me safe conduct until I arrive in Judah? And may I have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the royal park, So he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple, and for the city wall, and for the residence I will occupy. And because the gracious hand of, and unquote, this, that was him speaking to Artaxerxes, unquote, and because Nehemiah is writing and narrating, and because the gracious hand of my God was on me, the king granted my requests. So I went to the governors of Trans-Euphrates and gave them the king's letters, and the king had also sent army officers and cavalry with me. One thing we might note is how devout Nehemiah is as a faithful man. He accounts all of this good fortune, the king's favor to him, as actually the unseen hand of God being on him and protecting him and guiding this process of him returning to Judah. Now, a secondary source, a lot of us have been exposed to the writings of Josephus, who was a historian. Lots of times when you read Josephus, it is almost like word for word reading a chapter out of 1st or 2nd Kings or 1st or 2nd Chronicles. However, in other places, he will tell a similar account of what's in the Bible but give some additional information, so that whoever wrote the text that's in the Bible may have been more economical and left some things out in their account. Josephus claims, he describes the process of, I believe this was when he was, out of the book Antiquities of the Jews, book 11, chapter 5, section 6. According to Josephus, the chief governor of Syria, Phoenicia, and Samaria was Adaeus. Now, Syria, Phoenicia, and Samaria were like the three major regions of Trans-Euphrates. To the Persian government, Trans-Euphrates was like a state of the Union, and it had subdivisions and subdivisions and subdivisions. For instance, Yehud, the province of Judah, was a subdivision of the division of Samaria. So Josephus, when he's describing this move by Nehemiah, says that at the time there was a chief governor of Trans-Euphrates. His name was Adaeus. And the divisions of Trans-Euphrates were Syria, Phoenicia, which is on the coast, and then Samaria, which is down south, and that includes Judah and Jerusalem. Nehemiah would journey from Susa to Babylon, and from Babylon probably to Hamath, which was in northern Syria, and pass through Damascus. These are major cities he would pass through, which, as the most important cities in Syria, would be the residence of governors. From Damascus, Nehemiah may have visited Samaria, where he may have encountered Sanballat and Tobiah before reaching Jerusalem. So the Bible tells us in Nehemiah 2:9 that I went to the governors of Trans-Euphrates and gave them the king's letters. By governors there, he doesn't mean the governor, but the many different administrators. So in reference to, he describes, just think of it, you're the guard in a city, like a major city like Hamath or Damascus, and you're looking out, and here comes, you know, a couple of thousand people with Nehemiah, and he's got troops with him. Are you being invaded? Are you being attacked? The way for the king of Syria to send people out is to send warning, send advance warning, advance letters. Expect, I'm sending Nehemiah. He's going to have soldiers with him. They're going to be flying our colors. And that way nobody's surprised. But you have to have these credentials. And when he gets to that city, he can hand a scroll to them from the king. These letters from the king, he's passing out along the way. That's what the Bible tells us he did. And in a parallel account, Josephus describes each one of these three waves as being handled the same way. That the king doesn't say, shoo, go. And 50,000 people in the first wave show up somewhere, and nobody knows why they're here and what's their objective. They have these places have been warned. They carry with them paperwork, documents, credentials as to who they are, where they're going, and why they're going there, and who gave them the authority. Josephus describes each one of these journeys as being well-credentialed along the way. They're dropping paper wherever they go. In his account regarding the first wave, Cyrus also sent an epistle to the governors, again the governors, these administrators, that were in Syria, the contents whereof here follows, and it's really a repetition of his decree. And this is in reference to the first wave led by Zerubbabel. And so the Bible doesn't mention this, but it is in this parallel account. It appears from Josephus that that's the way the king handled sending somebody someplace. They carried documents with, they were loaded with documents. Stop in a major city here. This is why we're here. Drop it off. Go down, keep going south. Drop it off. And there would be documentation from where they started to where they end, representing themselves and expressing the king's will. And over and above this, Ezra 1:1, then the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia, to make a proclamation throughout his realm, and also to put it in writing. When the king of Persia issued a policy, it went out to all the provinces. And there were, I think, 127 provinces stretching from India to Egypt and up into what is now southern Russia, areas that were part of the Persian Empire at the time. And you would have a proclamation where somebody probably would stand in a place of public gathering, read it, and so that the public could hear it, and then also register this document of what the king had decreed. And it becomes part of the courthouse, the law library, or whatever, in the major powers of centers of power throughout the kingdom. So why would the people of the land treat this act of going up on the hill and resuming the construction of the temple, why would they treat it as some kind of mystery that was in doubt, and put it in the mind of Darius, cast doubt on it, that they make this claim that Cyrus told them to do this, and maybe you better check up and see if he really did. You look up and find the original decree. It makes you wonder what happened to all of this paperwork along the way. How did it disappear? Why was it such a mystery? This may be an indication right here at Ezra 4:5. They bribed officials to work against them and frustrate their plans during the entire reign of Cyrus, king of Persia, and down to the reign of Darius, king of Persia. When they came and tried to stop the construction and accuse them that they're not doing the right thing, why couldn't one of the elders of the Jews go up to Damascus or Hamath and ask for an affidavit that don't you have on file the paperwork that was dropped off here explaining this historical event, this decree by Cyrus. Why couldn't they have done that? Where did this paperwork go? It wasn't paper. Paper hadn't been invented. Probably scrolls. But why was this such a mystery? And it could be because the official records had been suppressed, lost. It says that the people of the land were crooked. They bribed officials. So for some reason, they thought they could put this in front of Darius as an improper move on the part of the Jews. So Ezra 5, verses 3 through 5, repeats this indication where they confront the Jews, who authorized you to rebuild this temple and to finish it? They also asked, what are the names of those who are constructing the building? But the eye of their God was watching over the builders, over the elders of the Jews, and they were not stopped until a report could go to Darius and his reply be received. Throughout Ezra and Nehemiah, you have the writer or either speaking for himself like Nehemiah or someone commenting on these actions that God had his hand, his protective hand over the people. In writing to Darius, they repeat that they asked the Jews, who authorized you to rebuild this temple and to finish it? We also asked them their names so that we could write them down, the names of their leaders, for your information. They're being so helpful. And if this event, this action displeased Darius, he would have an arrest list right there. He could come right back to Judah and go from house to house. Are you so and so? Okay, we're hanging you. They were being so helpful. They quote the Jews, who are totally honest. Because our ancestors angered the God of heavens, he gave them, talking about their ancestors, into the hands of Nebuchadnezzar. The Jews don't brag on themselves, and so because they confess this, this may be why the people of the land included this confession in the letter to characterize them as bad people. And so the response of the Jews is, however, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Babylon, King Cyrus issued a decree to build this house of God. And they go on to say how the treasures of the temple were given to Sheshbazzar. So this Sheshbazzar came and laid the foundations of the house of God in Jerusalem. From that day to the present, it has been under construction but is not yet finished. Now, I want you to remember that in this letter, this is the letter of the people of the land. They are quoting the Jews. And the Jews are saying that this has been under construction since that time but is not yet finished. What the people have not revealed is how they have interfered with this process. They start off the letter by remarking how remarkable the temple is. They're making great progress. They're building it with great stones. It's an impressive building. And they're really making progress. And yet, at the end of the letter, they quote the Jews as saying, this has been under construction for 16 years. How big is it going to be? They contradict themselves, and they let slip that this cessation of work for 15 or 16 years was their fault. It is not completed because it's going to be so big. It hasn't been constantly under construction because they stopped it. They don't reveal that about what has actually happened. Unquote. They stop quoting the Jews. Now, if it pleases the king, let a search be made in the royal archives of Babylon to see if King Cyrus did in fact issue a decree to rebuild this house of God in Jerusalem. Then let the king send us his decision in this matter. Now, we don't know if they are trying to be helpful again. Why don't you check around Babylon and see if you can find that decree? Or are they purposely misdirecting Darius? I don't know how they would know where the actual location of the decree would be. Turns out not to be in Babylon, but they don't go beyond that. Just check around Babylon and get back to us. King Darius then issued an order. He has people working for him, and they searched in the archives stored in the treasury of Babylon. So he did what they told him. A scroll was found in the citadel of Ecbatana in the province of Media, and this was written on it, Memorandum. In the first year of King Cyrus, the king issued a decree concerning the temple of God in Jerusalem. Let the temple be rebuilt at a place to present sacrifices, and let the foundations be laid. And King James Version and American Standard come closer to the original meaning of the Hebrew word masoblin, which King James and American Standard says, let the foundations be strongly laid. Cyrus is directing them not to just go and throw something together, but really make it solid. Masoblin comes from a word, sobel, which means load. Really pack it in. Make that foundation strong. I want this building to last. And so Darius goes above and beyond what they instruct him to do. Go to Babylon. Check around Babylon. And what he does is check Babylon. He may have been in Susa at the time, and he sends people as far as Ecbatana. And Ecbatana is from Susa, it's about 250 miles, and from Babylon to Susa, it's about 250 miles. So if they started out in Babylon, they went 500 miles to find this document. The people of the land would settle for no less than somebody laying eyes on the original decree, and Darius went that far, just from where he was, 500 miles to locate it. He went beyond what they requested. And he went the extra mile. Don't we love people who go the extra mile? That's what Jesus taught us in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5:41, and whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. That was the kind of person Darius was. Well, what are all these cities? And I want to take a kind of a sidebar to explain what these cities are. And we go all the way back to Nebuchadnezzar's dream. In Daniel 2, he had this terrible dream, and he needed a wise man to interpret it for him, that he saw a statue, and the statue had a head of gold, chest and armor on the arms of silver, The armor around the waist going down to the thighs was bronze, and the legs were iron. The feet were mixtures of iron and clay. Daniel explained to him that these are all the, and that a rock comes from heaven, strikes the statue at its feet, shatters it, topples it over, and that rock expands. And Daniel is explaining to him all of the significant kingdoms from Nebuchadnezzar's time forward that would be of consequence to humans, that they would have to answer to, that were supreme. The first, the gold head, was the Babylonian kingdom. The silver, it mentions armor on the chest and armor on the arms. And these are the Medes and the Persians. The waist armor, the armor around the waist and the down to the thighs, are made of bronze. That's the Greeks. The legs are of iron. The miry clay and mixture is the way the Roman Empire kind of diversified. But a rock comes, shatters it, and grows, and that's the last kingdom that will be supreme, and it is the kingdom of Christ. And it happens during the time of the last kings. Well, the description of the armor, that silver on the chest and on the arms, is in reference to the Medes and the Persians. That just as the Medes and the Persians were a composite government, this armor was kind of a collective term, the chest and the arms. It was of multiple parts. The Medes and the Persians lived on the east side of the Persian Gulf. Persians to the south, I think the Elamites to the south of them, and to the north were the Medes. And the Medes were, for the longest time, they were the superior power. And the Persians were subservient to the Medes. And under Cyrus, who was king of the Persians, he defeated the Medes. And in fact, he defeated his grandfather, the king of the Medes. And they became a consolidated force where the Persians became the superior power. And in essence, the Medes were absorbed into the Persian Empire. In that combination, they defeated the Babylonians at these dates. This is all under Cyrus in 539. And in defeating the Babylonians, they inherited everything the Babylonians owned, from India to Egypt, on up to southern Russia, over into Turkey. And that's what you have at the moment. That is the Persian Empire. But it started out, in many references, they talk about the Medes and the Persians. Well, as a result, Cyrus has three really nifty cities to govern from. Susa was the capital of the Persians. And that is a modern map of Iran, the location of where the Persian Empire was centered. Places to look and to research. That's why it wound up turning up in the archives at Ecbatana. These cities, by the way, are contain references or places of significance from the Bible. That kind of gives you a schematic. It's a worse map. The red stars are Ecbatana, Susa, and Babylon. the modern city that was Susa, the capital of Persia, is now called Shush, and that building with the turret that looks like it was made out of sugar cubes houses the tomb of Daniel. There are five places that claim that to be the burial place of Daniel. Because he was an administrator in the Persian kingdom, this is the most likely that it might be the authentic tomb. In Susa, the Persian capital, up in the capital of the Medes that the Persians used, Ecbatana was up north. It was 1,500 feet higher than Susa, and they called it the summer capital because it was cooler. It was more habitable and pleasant. And supposedly that building and those crypts are for Esther and Mordecai. And these things are maintained to this day. So Ezra 6 says that Darius then issued an order, and they searched at Babylon. They found the scroll in the citadel of Ecbatana in the province of Media, and this was written on it, memorandum. In the first year of King Cyrus, the king issued a decree concerning the temple of God in Jerusalem. Let the temple be rebuilt as a place to present sacrifice, and let the foundation be laid, strongly laid. Also, the gold and silver are to be returned to their places in the temple in Jerusalem. They are to be deposited in the house of God. Unquote from that decree. So Darius turns to the people who wrote him, Tatnai and Buznai. Now then, Tatnai, governor of Trans-Euphrates, and Shethar-Boznai, and your other officials of that province, stay away from there. Do not interfere with the work on this temple of God. Let the governor of the Jews and the Jewish elders rebuild this house of God on its site. Moreover, I hereby decree that you are to do for those elders of the Jews in the construction of this house of God. And he gives a list of things that basically are saying that the expenses for the construction should be fully paid from the revenues of your taxes that you collect in Trans-Euphrates. And this is to cover and make sure that the temple does not run out of food for the priests or sacrificial animals for the sacrifices. And he says, do this without fail, so that they may offer sacrifices pleasing to the God of heaven and pray for the well-being of the king and his sons. And he does a kind of, you remember when Inspector Columbo said, oh, by the way, Darius says, furthermore, I decree that if anyone defies this edict, a beam is to be pulled from their house, and they are to be impaled on it. And for this crime, their house is to be made a pile of rubble. May God, who has caused his name to dwell there, overthrow any king or people who lifts a hand to change this decree or to destroy this temple in Jerusalem. I, Darius, have decreed it. Let it be carried out with diligence. Now, this is promising a severe penalty, and Darius meant it. He was, penalties were harsh in Persia. I was trying to come up with an example, and in Daniel, when Daniel was thrown in the lion's den, Darius was his friend. And he tried to save him, but he had issued some kind of decree, everybody has to pray to me. And so informants found Daniel praying to God and not to Darius. And Darius tried to change his decree, but he couldn't. the Persian king, when he says something, it has to stick. So Daniel had to be put in the lion's den. And Darius comes the next morning and finds that Daniel has survived the night. And he believed in the power of Daniel's God to save him from these hungry lions. And so if you want to read Daniel 6:24, it's kind of grisly. It reports that Darius went and took the accusers of Daniel and their wives and their children and dropped them into the lion's den. And it sounds like they didn't even hit the floor before the animals were on them. We mentioned this punishment of, I'll take a beam from your house and impale you on it. This, of course, will make your children and your wife homeless. Well, this is even worse. When the Persian king says he'll punish you, he meant it. Then, because of the decree King Darius had sent Tatnai, governor of Trans-Euphrates, and Shethar-Bozenai and their associates, carried it out with diligence. So the elders of the Jews continued to build and prosper under the preaching of Haggai and the prophet and Zechariah, a descendant of Iddo. They finished building the temple according to the command of the God of Israel and the decrees of Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes, kings of Persia. They may have mentioned Artaxerxes, just the narrator, the historian, fit his name in, because later on Artaxerxes may have contributed some funding to embellish the temple. And the temple was completed on the third day of the month of Adar in the sixth reign of the year of Darius. So it took them 4 years. They started reconstruction in the second year of Darius and finished it in the fourth year of his reign. And so we've got the temple rebuilt, and there is a passage, there is a gap in Ezra that is actually about 58 years. And we don't know what happens in the meantime. We can only assume that the funding continued to a degree, that the temple was able to function, they were able to sacrifice, and temple worship had resumed, and people were able to come there and make their sacrifices. And next week we'll pick up where Ezra arrives, and this again is an initiative from the government, from the king of Persia. He wants to send Ezra, who is a scholar of the law, and evaluate the legal system of the people of Judah and make sure that they have a legal system and structure that complies with God's law, of which Ezra was a specialty. Have any questions? Anybody want to defy the king of Persia? Thanks for your attention, and